Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins, in for Meghna Chakrabarty.
Tuesday will be a year. It has been a long year. It has been a painful year. It has been very frustrating for me and my family. For your life to change within a blink of an eye, I still don't know why.
That was George Floyd's sister, Bridget, speaking in downtown Minneapolis yesterday, marking 1 year since the death of her brother ignited demonstrations across the country and led to calls once again for America to reckon with its history of racism and police violence. And now Yale historian Elizabeth Hinton is calling for another reckoning. She proposes that we reframe our understanding of activism and oppression going back to the 1960s civil rights era. Her new book is America on Fire, The Untold History of Police Violence and Black Rebellion Since the 1960s. And she joins us now from New Haven, Connecticut. Elizabeth, welcome to On Point.
Thank you so much for having me, Kimberly.
So, as we said, this week marks the one-year anniversary since George Floyd's death. And I want you to begin this conversation by telling us, over this past year, what has come to you about how this resonates back to the 1960s, the protests that we see today, and how it relates directly back to that time.
Well, there were many features of the mass mobilization and the growing chorus for calls for racial justice that we witnessed last summer that resonated and resembled the extreme violence and the protests of the 1960s, of the civil rights and Black Power eras. But there are a number of things that were quite distinct. I mean, the sheer number of people who took to the streets themselves. I mean, some have called last summer the largest mass mobilization in United States history. The deep diversity and coalitions that were behind the protests, and the sustained nature of the protests themselves, but also the conversations that their actions generated. You know, systemic racism has become a buzzword in a way that we haven't ever seen before. We're beginning to have new conversations about racial justice, about how to solve the crisis of policing and the related problem of incarceration and mass criminalization, and to think about what the root causes are of racial inequality and what we might do to stop it. At the same time, too, we've seen the shoring up and the mobilization of repressive forces, white supremacy, and a real effort to try to narrow the acceptable history and how we have these conversations about race and what is taught or can be taught to our nation's children about our deeply devastating and harrowed racial history in this country.
Mm-hmm. And you bring up the issue of how we talk about this. Tell us why you wrote your book, America on Fire, and why you think a reframing is necessary.
So part of what I think is really important to understand is that, you know, the police violence, the extreme and tragic moments of police violence that really we've been witnessing all too frequently since Barack Obama's second term have a much, much longer history. You know, they didn't just begin in 2014 with Michael Brown. I think, you know, one difference is that everybody has these portable cameras in their pockets on their cell phones. And so now we have documented proof of the extent of police violence that Black communities have been rallying around for years and have been drawing attention to for years, but that, you know, was really hard to actually be taken seriously or to be seen as truthful. And now we have these videos that make the extent of police violence in low-income communities of color just undeniable. And so, you know, one of the things that I wanted to do was to say that these dynamics, police violence and community mobilization, have been happening for quite some time, that they really came to a head during the 1960s in the context of the civil rights movement and endured through the remainder of the 1960s and into the 1970s on a scale and a frequency that occurred far more regularly than we previously thought. And that, you know, these incidents weren't just these kind of major moments that we often think of. So Watts in 65 and Detroit and Newark in 67, that they happened all across the United States, in the South, in the Rust Belt, in the Sun Belt, in the Northeast, the deindustrializing Midwest, in big cities and small cities. And that this history of police violence and community resistance has a deep, deep history that, really, you know, from 68 to the early 70s was the most widely adopted form of protest among young Black people. If we ever want to think about solutions for today, if we ever want to think about how we might finally overcome this cycle of police violence and protests, then we have to deal with not only the root causes of the unrest, but also acknowledge all of the alternatives that were consistently presented to officials at all levels of government, who in turn embraced the wrong policy term, and that is to continue and escalate an investment in policing and incarceration as a way to manage poverty and racial inequality. And now we're you know, at this reckoning, we're at this crossroads, and we have to think about how we might realize a different set of domestic policies and privilege a different set of priorities.
And before we get to that, I want to go back for a moment and center. You mentioned 1965, 1967, when we saw some of these historic uprisings, if you will, and one of them was in my hometown of Detroit. Let's listen to a 1967 CBS News report on the Detroit unrest.
Fire Chief Charles Quinlan made a first estimate of $100 million damage. Ignited by firebombs or just matches and paper, flames and smoke swallowed the sky, holding back the dawn. Firemen left some areas burning when snipers opened up from rooftops and windows. Some Negroes took arms to protect the firemen. Well over 100 are injured, 3 confirmed dead, 1 white woman by sniper fire, 1 looter shot by a store owner, and a sniper killed by a National Guardsman. Police say the vandals and arsonists are working over 8 different areas, 139 square miles in all.
So is this a matter, in the way that we talk about this and understand these events, is it a matter of perception, Elizabeth? Is it that one man's uprising might be seen as another person's riot? I know growing up in Detroit, it was very much, depending on who you spoke to, gave a very different framing of what happened there in 1967.
Right. And, you know, many, if not most Detroiters don't label the events of the summer of 1967 as the Detroit riot. They call it the Detroit Rebellion or the Great Rebellion. Mm-hmm. So terminology has so much to do with the way that these incidents were both reported on, as we just heard, but also responded to. And that's part of the reason why in my book, you know, I really encourage us to not think about these acts of political violence as riots, but as rebellion. From, you know, the first kind of major incident of urban unrest, which occurred in Harlem in 1964, so 3 years before the rebellion in Detroit, that happened after a 15-year-old Black high school student in Harlem was shot and killed by a New York City police officer. The root causes of the unrest, of course, you know, police violence is very often the precipitating incident. But the reason why, you know, residents feel they have no recourse or won't see any justice unless they embrace sets of violent tactics has to do with the same kind of socioeconomic grievances expressed by mainstream civil rights organizations. That is, you know, the rebellions were about employment, access, you know, decent jobs, decent housing, expanded educational opportunities, and basically full political and economic inclusion in American society, as well as an end to police brutality and protection from white supremacist violence. These were both the goals of the civil rights movement and the Black Power movement, and were often expressed through incidents of political violence from Harlem to Detroit. But when Lyndon Johnson reflected on the events of the summer of 1964 in Harlem, he said, you know, this incident has nothing to do with civil rights whatsoever. It is criminal. It is senseless. It's tied to juvenile delinquency problems in our city. And it's a riot. And in labeling this political violence as such, labeling violence that was very much rooted, again, in socioeconomic conditions, the only response to that violence ended up being more policing, more surveillance, which, of course, is the very thing that caused cities to erupt in the first place. And in failing to acknowledge the socioeconomic root causes of the unrest, we've been stuck in this cycle ever since, where we have effectively failed to prevent the conditions that lead to the cycle of police violence and Black rebellion in the first place, and instead have continued to embrace police as a way to manage the problem. So we've been, again, stuck in this place where police become the only solution.
And we've seen that today. I mean, reading your book, thinking about this, I think about Ferguson. We saw this police response to the protests there being militarized. We saw out in front of the White House last year a clearing by federal authorities of protesters right in front of the White House. Why do you think these lessons are so difficult to learn in the few seconds we have before we take a break?
Well, I think in part because of the way that we legitimize certain forms of protest, the fact that, you know, whether nonviolent or violent Black protest for racial justice is always immediately criminalized. I mean, I think it's important that the protests in Ferguson began as nonviolent police vigils, and police responded to this nonviolent protest with tear gas and with baton sticks.
Okay, I'm going to pause you there. We're looking at American civil rights history with Yale historian Elizabeth Hinton, 1 year after George Floyd's death. I'm Kimberly Atkins. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins. I'm speaking with Yale historian Elizabeth Hinton about her push to reframe our understanding of the civil rights era 1 year after George Floyd's death. Her new book is America on Fire, The Untold History of Police and Black Rebellion Since the 1960s. So, Elizabeth, you mentioned President Lyndon B. Johnson, who was president during the main thrust of these demonstrations in the 1960s. Here he is in July of 1967 addressing the violent protests in cities across the nation.
And we will continue to press for laws which would protect our citizens from violence, like the Safe Streets and Crime Control Act now under consideration in the Congress, and the Gun Control Act. And our work has just begun. Yet there are those who feel that even this beginning is too much.
So, Elizabeth, you mentioned that the president responded by really criticizing the protest instead of getting to the root of the causes, as you pointed to, over-policing of black folks, lack of jobs, lack of economic opportunity, lack of education, investment. Tell us how you see that carrying on, and why is that an important point to make?
Yeah, and this, you know, I think that Johnson quote in many ways captured, you know, a lot of the complexity behind his domestic programs in the Great Society that we haven't reckoned with. Because, of course, you know, 1 year before, Johnson called the war on crime and began developing the programs that would lead to that Safe Streets Act that he mentioned. In 65, he calls for the war on poverty. 64, 65, he calls for the war on crime. And so there is this element of his domestic policies that are acknowledging, that is an attempt to acknowledge some of those larger socioeconomic root causes. But in the end, unfortunately, the federal government's war on crime, which began an unprecedented investment into local police forces, prisons, and court systems beginning in the mid-1960s, is what ended up being the longer-term lasting legacy of his administration. Really, the expansion of American police forces and the origins of the programs that led to ultimately mass incarceration as we experience it in this country today.
I want to bring into this conversation now Jeff Kirkland. He is the founder of the African American Historical Preservation Society of York, Pennsylvania, and he was in York in 1968 during the uprisings there. Jeff, welcome to On Point.
Yes, thank you.
I want you to reflect on this conversation that we're having and first start off with, over this last year, how you have seen the connection between what you witnessed there in York and what you're seeing across the country with these protests over the last year since George Floyd's death.
Well, you know, York certainly has a history of rebellions and uprisings since the early 1800s. It was a great incident called the Conspiracy of 1803, where blacks rebelled and almost burned the town down for 6 weeks. They were burning barns and burning houses, and the governor had to send in the National Guard. And in that sort of vein, although many of the incidents did not happen because of police incidences, it happened because of the greater structural racism that continues here in Europe, to the point that we're closer to the Kerner Commission report, when they say we're headed towards two different societies, one white, one black, and all like that. We're closer to that than we are to the great melting pot here in New York. There's still festering below the surface that structural racism. We probably have more segregated clubs here in New York and political organizations per square mile than any other place in Pennsylvania. And there is just a lack of opportunity here for the young folks. So I think we're, you know, not too far from where, you know, the incidences that happened in the 60s. We're not really far away from there. Many people speak of a tinderbox effect here. That's just take one police incident or something else before we have another incident like those in the 60s.
So, Jeff, explain to our listeners what happened in York during the summers of 1968 and 1969, when we saw the violent clashes, clashes between the citizens and police.
Yes, and that's where one lady that was visiting her parents from the South was ended up killed, and a policeman was also killed during the 69 riots, the uprisings, we call them. Coincidental that you're talking about reframing and rebranding, you know, the terminology here, because we had a professor at York College, Dr. Peter Levy, who just wrote a book on the Great Uprising, and that was his aim, and that was to rebrand that terminology and all. I think most people bought into what the mainstream media was presenting at the time, calling them riots and all. But in the first incident was my brother Kerry and a few of friends of him were coming back from a swimming pool that ended up being segregated, and there was an incident, a fight, and between a white gang and some of the guys that were coming back, my brother and them, and they were walking down one section of that part of town, and a shot rang out and hit my friend right next to my brother Kerry. It almost killed the guy, Toppin Sweeney. A policeman was standing right there at the time. And when that incident happened, a lot of the Black folks in town got together and, you know, guns came out. And we were all back and forth rebelling, shooting for probably the next week or so before the National Guard again was brought in. It was a similar incident that happened in 69. And myself and a few friends, we were coming home from a party and making a lot of noise coming down the alley. And one of the guys, a white man that lived in that area, shouted down to us, "Why don't you N-word kids stop all that noise?" And somebody said, "Well, why don't you stop us?" And he came out with a shotgun and just started firing and shooting. And he shot 11 people that night. And things broke out again. And that's the year the policeman was killed. He was in an armored car, and somebody had a pretty powerful gun and shot through the armored car and killed him. But anyway, the guy that did the shooting, he got let off because of lack of evidence, so-called. Even though the 11 people were shot, my brother Eric still has the buckshot in his back from that day, because it was just too harmful to cut through the muscle to take all those out. So he's still wearing those buckshots to today. In that type of atmosphere, you know, like I say, it's just festering below the surface here in New York. There's many efforts put forth to try to mediate the racism here in New York. You know, it's making incremental progress, just minimal progress, I think.
Yeah, and the woman who was killed that you mentioned was Lily Bell Allen, who was visiting from South Carolina. And the officer was Henry Schad, who was in that armored car. Elizabeth, I wanted to turn to you and hearing how the incidents from the 60s still reverberate today, as Jeff was saying, there in York and across the country. It seems to be emblematic of what we were talking about.
Right. They still reverberate today, and they also reverberate back. I mean, I think it was really important that Mr. Kirkland opened up his remarks by talking about the conspiracy of 1803 in New York. And, you know, my work focuses on the kind of extreme violence of the late 60s and early 70s. But the threat of Black rebellion has, you know, been a part of the history of the United States from its very beginning. Black people have, and people of color have consistently resisted the various forms of oppression, the state-sanctioned violence that's been inflicted against them. I think it also, you know, says a lot that, you know, Mr. Kirkland was talking about one of the gentlemen who was shot by a police officer who still has a buckshot in his back, I believe, as a result of getting shot at by police. I mean, this shows literally that our communities and that individuals still bear the scars of this period, and that, you know, despite the civil rights movement and despite even a reckoning in New York to a certain extent, you know, we have still failed to resolve structural racism in this country. Cities are still segregated. And a really important aspect of the York Rebellion is that the police were deeply, deeply entwined with the white gangs that Mr. Kirkland mentioned at one point during the unrest, which, as Peter Levy, the historian, who's really the expert on what happened in New York in particular, said that, you know, this was the most severe rebellion given the size of the city of the entire era. It lasted for over a week. And a police officer named Charlie Robertson and others literally handed out ammunition to white power gangs in the city who ended up shooting Lily Bell Allen and terrorizing her family. And Charlie Robertson eventually became mayor of York. And so I think, you know, again, the York story underscores both the ties between white supremacy and law enforcement that we've seen very clearly, especially in the aftermath of the attack on the Capitol on January 6th, as more information has come to light, but also the ways in which, you know, white supremacists have risen to power, and what, you know, at all levels of government. In the case of York, you know, the person who gave the bullets that killed Lily Bell Allen became mayor. And that's important.
Yeah. And Jeff, I want to say that it also, a lot of what we've seen over the last year is a response of a perceived and actual lack of justice. So often the people involved are not brought to justice. We've seen the majority of cases, if charges are brought at all, there are usually acquittals. And it took a long time to get any semblance of justice for Miss Allen's death there in York. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, it certainly did. Like the previous speaker was saying, our mayor, Mr. Robinson, who eventually became mayor, was one of the guys that was handing out ammunition during that time to the white gangs and all. And, you know, just what happened in York, the powers that be, they call them the movers and shakers. They would rather not talk about those things. That's why justice took a long time coming. People would rather not talk. They had maybe over almost 100 of those powerful people in town sign letters chastising the newspaper for even bringing that type of discussion to the surface, you know, as far as justice and all. You have an incident right now that's going on because there was a policeman here that reenacted the George Floyd incident at a party. And I was laughing about it, and some of the people at the party took offense and raised concern about that. And the officer was suspended. But then he went before a hearing board comprised mostly of the police union, and they acquitted him of that, and they tried to get him back on the job. Right now, he's still not on the job, you know, but it just goes to show the intertwining, you know, of the powers and the racism that goes on here in New York. And people just don't feel there's any semblance of justice. I just thank God that there hasn't been a major incident like the George Floyd incident that would be the spark for a major protest here again in New York. We had a police chief right now who is African-American, grew up here in New York, and he's trying to his best to rebrand the relationship between the police and the community, even to the point where he's talking about bringing back police dogs, which were a serious point of contention during those days because dogs were used to corral and harass people here in the community. Well, he's bringing the dogs back, a different type of dog, as service dogs, sort of, you know, to intervene with people who need or who respond to that type of issue. I told him it was a risky idea, but if anybody could pull it off, he could. And it would be another step towards him trying to rebrand that relationship between the community and the police.
And it took until 2001, before a grand jury recommended charges be brought against men in response to the death by Allen. There was also charges brought in response to the death of the police officer. Just in the last couple of minutes that we have, Jeff, where do you think York goes from here, and how has the last year since George Floyd's death impacted where it's moving next?
Well, like I said earlier, there is, I think, a lot more movement towards reconciliation and trying to address the issues here in York. Some people that moved to York, and some of the younger folks, you know, I call them the Trayvon Martin generation, you know, are now becoming involved in the social atmosphere here. And I do have hope and optimism, you know, that energy will build here in the community and will move towards helping us become that idealistic melting pot rather than that separate one nation here or there. I think York has made some decent progress, I have to say that. And it's a work in progress.
Yeah. Well, Jeff Kirkland is founder of the African American Historical Preservation Society in York, Pennsylvania. Thank you so much for joining us, Jeff.
You're welcome.
And Elizabeth, I mean, how is that to listening to that and seeing how things have changed, but not very much in this community? Mm-hmm. It's a small community. We talk a lot about big cities like Detroit and Chicago, but this is playing out. I mean, this seems to me sort of more of a microcosm of what's likely happening in communities across this country.
Right, exactly. And that's why I think it's really important that we begin to pay more attention. This is one of the things that I really stress in the book that, you know, it is in communities like York, it's in these smaller communities where we really see these dynamics of police violence and the impact of lack of investment into jobs and robust schools and healthcare and protection from white vigilante violence for people really, really play out in particularly tragic ways. And we need to start paying attention to the dynamics that are happening in smaller cities like York, that are so pervasive in communities across the United States that often get overlooked by the media and scholars.
Yeah. We are discussing America's reckoning with its history on police violence and in protests against racism with Yale historian Elizabeth Hinton, who is the author of America on Fire, The Untold History of Police Violence and Black Rebellion since the 1960s. I am Kimberly Atkins, and this is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins. Tomorrow marks the one-year anniversary of George Floyd's murder and the uprising of racial justice activism across the country. How are you reflecting on the protest movement that began 1 year ago? How do you want to mark this moment in history? What progress do you think the country has made? What work is left to be done? Tell us your story at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. Today, we're talking about America's history of police violence and protest with Yale historian Elizabeth Hinton. Now, Elizabeth, I want to dig more into policy to move this conversation forward. I've heard a lot of people saying that policing is a local issue, but what about the federal role? I mean, a lot of things, including money that was given to local police departments or militarized equipment, was given to local police departments from the federal government, from a federal government program that has been a fight here in Washington ever since the scenes that we saw in places like Ferguson. And I'm thinking of the description that Jeff was describing of in York, of these armored vehicles that the police occupied. That's federal. Federal money goes to expanding policing programs. So is this really a local issue?
Yeah, and that's again why, you know, this period of the 60s in the Johnson administration is so important, because during the Johnson administration, the federal government began to take an active role in law enforcement at the local level and shaped outcomes and incentivized certain sets of priorities. And very much of, you know, the reason in many ways, one of the primary reasons why Johnson called the war on crime in the first place and began this investment was in response to Black rebellion and the continued threat of Black rebellion in the nation's cities. Johnson said, okay, we have to somehow figure out a way. The federal government has to step in to help local law enforcement combat unrest. Again, you know, thinking about how authorities respond to certain issues and what what sets of policies get prioritized. So beginning with that Safe Streets Act that we mentioned earlier, the Omnibus Crime Control and Safe Streets Act of 68, which marked the official launch of the war on crime and the federal government's investment into local law enforcement, federal government began to allocate hundreds of millions of dollars to crime control programs at all levels and forced state and local governments to establish planning agencies in order to qualify for this new funding. The funding was administered through an agency called the Law Enforcement Assistance Administration and the Department of Justice. And again, it's really important that the Office of Economic Opportunity, which ran the War on Poverty, which allocated federal grants to grassroots organizations, community action grants, never received this kind of permanent implementation at the national level. So again, you know, this really reflects the Johnson administration's ultimate priorities. What the Safe Streets Act does is, in addition to establishing these state and local level criminal justice planning agencies, is begin to transfer surplus military weapons from Vietnam and interventions in Latin America and the Caribbean to local police departments. So, you know, a lot of people thought that when they saw the armored tanks in Ferguson, that this was a war on terror thing. No, it goes back to the war on Vietnam and the Johnson administration, when all of a sudden cities big and small received those armored vehicles. They received helicopters, tear gas, riot helmets, bulletproof vests, three-foot baton sticks, you name it. And these weapons are kind of ubiquitous in policing today, but they had their origins in this moment, in the moment of extreme violence and rebellion, and as part of the federal government's intervention. And of course, over time, as a result of this, of these incentives that the federal government facilitated and the investment in expanding criminal justice institutions, police forces, and prisons, this is how we get to the mass incarceration society that the United States is today. So in many ways, policing in the everyday is a local matter, but the federal government has a profound, profound influence in shaping local priorities and in supporting local and state governments in militarizing police forces and embracing a set of strategies that consistently has targeted low-income communities of color.
And so, and as such, one crucial part of the last several years of the Black Lives Matter movement has been the idea of defunding the police, defunding some of these programs that you're talking about. And we saw some local police departments respond to that and say that they would divert millions of dollars in funds into other community programs that took it away from police enforcement. But as the rise in crime happened in several cities across the country over the last several months, we are now seeing police departments like the one in Los Angeles saying they're going to add police officers. Los Angeles said they're going to add 250 police officers to its force. How do you see that? And what does history tell us about this back and forth?
Right. And this is, again, why, you know, we really need to look to community members and activists for different sets of solutions. Because I think if one thing my work shows is that, you know, the continued embrace of these punitive policies at the expense of programs that might address socioeconomic root causes of crime and violence has not necessarily worked to keep our most vulnerable community safe, and has resulted in the U.S. being home to the largest prison system in the world. When I think about defunding police and what that means, that's a call for a different set of investments. Again, you know, the set of investments that people were demanding when they took to the streets, both, you know, as nonviolent protesters, but in moments of violent protesters saying, okay, if we really want to address racial inequality, then we need a massive investment of resources into under-resourced, vulnerable communities. And this is, in fact, what the National Advisory Commission on Civil Disorders, or the Kerner Commission, called for back in 68. Johnson convened the Kerner Commission during the Detroit Rebellion of 1967 to evaluate the causes and consequences of the unrest that had rocked the nation during every summer of his presidency. And the Kerner Commission came up with a number of recommendations that the federal government and Johnson were pretty resistant to. They said, okay, you know, Mr. Kirkland mentioned the kind of famous line, the nation is moving towards two societies, black and white, separate and unequal. and that white racism was very much to blame for the unrest in American cities. And they said, okay, if we want to actually effectively prevent rebellion in the future, we need a we need a Marshall Plan for American cities. We need a massive investment into communities that are vulnerable to rebellion, and not in the form of more policing and surveillance, which is what they ultimately got, but in the form of a major new job creation program that would galvanize both the public and private sectors, investments into public school systems, the complete overhaul of public housing. These were the things that the federal government's own, the president's own task force had said would address the root causes. These are very similar to the same calls people are talking about, the same kinds of programs and investments that people are talking about when they say defund the police. We have tried the policing and incarceration as a way to manage poverty and inequality. And now we're in a moment where we actually have to begin to make a new set of investments to get at the root causes, or else this cycle will continue and inequality in the United States will deepen.
So a couple of points that I want to ask you about on those policies, as you were describing the Kerner Commission and the calls for this new plan to address things, including white supremacy in the country. I can't help but think right now about the debate over the January 6th Commission to get at the root of what happened with the insurrection, including the white nationalist elements there. And also the way that attack is being framed very differently, or trying to be equivalences drawn between that and the Black Lives Matter movement. And that gets right to this idea of how we frame and what we call these things.
Right. Continue consistently. And this very much, as we've been talking about, played out in what happened in New York. Calls for racial justice because of the very threat to white supremacy itself, and the kind of the idea that if we take the demands of protesters seriously, protesters who are calling for this different set of investments, that are calling for policymakers to finally realize the founding principle of equality and step in to address racial discrimination, to step into it, to make conditions more equitable. This is seen as a threat to many of the foundations of the United States itself. And I think, it's pretty incredible that many conservative policymakers and Republicans in Congress are willing to turn their backs on the police in this case, understanding exactly what happened to put during the attack on January 6th to put so many Congress people and police officers in danger as a way to uphold white supremacy. In the end, white supremacy is what wins out. And this is really what's at stake right now, and what we're kind of in a battle over. What kind of country, what do our founding principles represent, and what kind of country should the United States be? And the vision that racial justice activists have seem diametrically opposed to the vision that many of those who attacked the Capitol on January 6th have and did, and that many elected officials are willing to turn their back on, or to refuse to understand the deeper causes and consequences of what led to that violence and that attack on their own lives and well-being.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I left 140 police officers injured. One police officer died, and several more took their own lives after that event. Now, there's also other legislation that has been introduced to address this that came right out of the Black Lives Matter movement, including the BREATHE Act, which is a very expansive look and looking at a lot of the economic and other factors that we talked about in what leads to these sort of clashes over policing, and also the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act, which is much more narrowly focused on police reform itself. But both of those are facing a tremendous amount of opposition in the Congress. A much more narrow potential police reforming act may be passed. What does that say to you about the likelihood of a federal response to violent policing?
Well, I'm still hopeful that those of us who want to see racial justice and who want to build a different kind of country are going to keep the pressure on our elected officials to help bring about the changes that we want to see. I think another lesson from history, and a lesson that I emphasize again and again in my book, is that, you know, police reforms have been tried in the past, and that we have to go beyond the police. The police reforms have not stopped except brutality and killings. I mean, you know, the George Floyd Justice Act, one of the centerpieces is banning the use of chokeholds. But in 1991, when Los Angeles police officers beat Rodney King horribly, hitting him and kicking him 40 times with their batons and with their fists and feet, they said that they, you know, resorted to that force because chokeholds had been banned among the LAPD. So, you know, the kind of curbing violence, stopping the use of mace and certain chemical weapons, even the use of body cams. I mean, we know, we just saw with Andrew Brown Jr., you know, body cams don't prevent killings. And especially when authorities refuse to release the footage, they don't necessarily help us hold officers more accountable or understand what happened during a moment of excessive force. We have to move beyond police reforms. And we have to think, and this is, again, you know, I think what the spirit of the defund movement is about, is thinking about ways that we can conceive of public safety beyond the police, ways that we can empower people in communities to keep communities safe, ways that we can have a robust understanding of what crime prevention means, and look to those institutions and services that the Kerner Commission drew our attention to more than a half century ago that went unheeded. You know, instead of investing in police, invest in robust schools, invest in early childhood education, which we know has a direct impact on one's likelihood to come in contact with police and serve time in prison in the future, and invest in jobs for young people in vulnerable communities. There are all different kinds of approaches that we can make to dealing with the problems of crime and violence in our communities that don't necessarily always lead to the presence of a uniformed officer with a gun that, as we know, can very often escalate a situation.
And I want to, in the last couple minutes we have left, sort of close our discussion sort of where we started and how we frame, how we think about these protests. I know in the last year I've heard a lot of people describe the Black Lives Movement, saying that it was violent and saying, you know, in the 1960s, Martin Luther King was peaceful. Those protests were peaceful. That's the kind of thing that Black Lives Matter should be doing. What would be your response to listeners who still think of it in that way, and that what we're seeing now is different than what happened in the 60s?
Well, you know, I would also point their attention to one really important aspect of the kind of landscape of protests in the 60s that King recognized, and that is that the success of nonviolent protests often depended on the presence or the threat of violent protests, should those nonviolent demands not be met. So I think, you know, throughout the history of the Black Freedom Movement, both forms of nonviolent and violent protests have ultimately been integral to its success. And last summer, you know, the vast majority of protests were nonviolent. And again, and I mentioned this earlier, but, you know, from Ferguson on and in Minneapolis and in Portland, in cities that did end up experiencing property destruction and forms of violence, the protests started out peacefully. They started peacefully as vigils. They started peacefully as people marching through the streets. And when police got violent, the people who were demanding racial justice, some of them responded with a set of violent tactics. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we have to begin to stop this cycle of investment in police and police, yeah, as being the people who are managing inequality, if we want to get out of where we've been since the civil rights movement and really realize
Elizabeth,
that equality.
I gotta close this, but Elizabeth Hinton is the professor of history and African American studies at Yale. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Kimberly.
I'm Kimberly Atkins. This is On Point.